in holographic conformal field theories and how you can understand these types of phenomena using ADS-CFT and study them via gravitational collapse. So I think it's fair to say that ADS-CFT, that holography has taught us a lot about real-time physics. In the last 5 years or so, we've learned a lot about things like radiation and jets, quasi-normal modes, which tell you the characteristic relaxation times when you're near equilibrium. We've learned a lot about how we can understand hydrodynamics from gravity. We've learned a lot about transport coefficients, et cetera. Something that has been much less studied is far from equilibrium dynamics, in particular things where, for example, a quark gluon plasma is formed, thermalization, and turbulence. And it isn't because these aren't interesting things. It's just because they involve studying ADS-CFT within the context of a non-trivial, non-linear time-dependent bulk geometry, something that you cannot access with a pencil and paper. Well, one particular example that I'm going to focus on today for, it'll be the theme of the talk, one particular example of far from equilibrium dynamics is that of a heavy ion collision. So in a heavy ion collision, you start off with an initial state which consists of two nuclei, which are in the process of colliding. They're Lorentz contracted. And you end up with a final state, or rather, more precisely, an intermediate state, which is a quark gluon plasma, something which the experiments at RIC suggest behaves as a nearly ideal liquid, something which is very different than the initial state of two colliding nuclei. And hydrodynamic simulations of collisions at RIC tell us that this process happens. You go from two colliding nuclei to a liquid in a time of one Fermi over C. It's extremely fast. So one thing that must happen here in the middle is that right after the collision, the system must be very anisotropic. So if you imagine thinking about this as a bunch of quarks and gluons, what's going to happen is that in the local rest frame of the system right here, your quarks and gluons will have momenta primarily distributed in the perpendicular to the collision axis, simply because anything that had momentum in this direction would have exited the mid-rapidity zone. So it's very far from equilibrium. And of course, when the system is starting to behave as a liquid, locally it's isotropic. Now, understanding how you go from here to here has been a challenging task. If you go on ahead and use perturbation theory and assume that the relevant mechanisms are simply scattering, you end up with a thermalization time which is roughly 3 times larger than this. In addition to just being off by a factor of 3, your theoretical uncertainties are order 1 simply because perturbation theory doesn't really work that well in this regime. So the utility of something like holography is that you can take a process which superficially at least, and I'll be a little bit more precise by what I mean by that, resembles a heavy ion collision, and you can map that into a classical gravitational problem in 5 dimensions. And here's the cartoon, and I'll describe this in more detail later on. In particular, you take a process which maps into the formation of a black hole in 5 dimensions. And so if you can go on ahead and study this process numerically on a computer, you get out of this all physics, from far from equilibrium dynamics to hydrodynamic evolution, all in one calculation. So that is the power of holography. We can ask questions like, what are the mechanisms responsible for far from equilibrium relaxation? We can ask how quickly things relax. We can see if we get a number which is similar to this. We can ask how our initial conditions imprinted on the late time hydrodynamic evolution, and et cetera. We can get everything in one calculation. So, but we should be honest about it, though. And the unfortunate, sad, cold, hard truth is that while we know of many theories with holographic descriptions, we do not know of any holographic description of QCD. So the best that we can currently do at the moment is access theories which are, in some sense, QCD-ish. We can mimic the strongly coupled dynamics of QCD plasma, but in doing so, we're going to have to omit certain features of QCD. And for today, I'm going to talk about conformal field theories alone, and one of the important features that we're going to omit is asymptotic freedom. So let me compare and contrast a collision in QCD versus that of a holographic conformal field theory.
Before you go there, can I ask a question? What are the initial conditions that goes into the hydrostatic
It's something which, so they go under the name of Glauber initial conditions and color glass condensate initial conditions. I don't know the details about them, but at some level they're best guesses. And answers that you get for your hydrodynamic, answers that you get from your hydrodynamic fits for things like the viscosity and whatnot are fairly sensitive to which set of initial conditions that you use. Okay.
But the time from which the hydro simulation is a good description, that is also an input parameter.
I think that's an output parameter, actually. That's something that comes from fitting to the data. So in QCD, it's on a conformal theory. There exist bound states, things like nuclei. In a conformal theory, there is no energy scale to set a mass. And so instead of colliding nuclei, you're colliding clumps of energy that you get to distribute however you choose. In QCD, if you have high enough energy collisions, the early time dynamics will be weakly coupled because QCD is an asymptotically free theory. In a conformal theory, if you have strongly coupled dynamics at late times, you have strongly coupled dynamics at early times. Now, at RIC, we believe that we produce a strongly coupled quark gluon plasma at late times. We know the same type of thing will happen here. So the message that I want to send here is simply that this is not a controlled approximation to the real world. Okay. Now, that is a big loss, but if you think about it, QCD has been around for 35 years or so, and yet in the 35 years that QCD has been around, nobody's been ever been able to do any calculation that runs through all these dynamics right here. So while this is a big loss, it's certainly very nice that we at least have a toy model to study far from equilibrium dynamics.
So at 3Q, you would expect alpha s to be equal to 1, right? So you're not... The energy is just not enough.
Why should alpha S be order 1 in the immediate moments after the collision?
Because you can compute what's the energy for whatever.
I don't think anybody knows the right answer at the moment.
Even if we go about 3 or 5 times past in a lattice plateau for the equation of state, it will still stay far away from the gas.
Sure. So perturbation theory doesn't work well for the pressures of QCD, but it works well for other things. For some quantities, it works great.
So is that an accepted statement that it's a very first instances in the RIC collision that's described by perturbative?
No.
Okay, so
No. My point here is simply that if you did crank up the energy high enough, you would be guaranteed that it would happen.
I'm saying that at the current experiment, the energy is not set.
I don't think anybody knows the answer to this simply because nobody's been able to access it either theoretically or experimentally. So.
There's a question, Mark.
Yeah, if you do crank up the energy high enough, you can remove the question mark. Okay. So with all these caveats said, I want to just proceed with just the idea that this is just an interesting field theory problem to study, and we'll come to the interpretations at the end. So please allow me to be a little bit pedagogical here in my introduction of ADS-CFT. I'm not really going to tell you much about the details. I'm just going to tell you what you need to know to understand the rest of my talk. So the simplest state to study in a quantum field theory is the vacuum state. And if ADS-CFT is correct, each state in the quantum field theory should correspond to some classical field configuration in the gravitational theory. The vacuum has no stress, no energy and momentum. It has no charge. It's translationally invariant, etc. If there's any justice in the world of ADS-CFT, that should correspond to the most symmetric solution to the classical five-dimensional equations. And you can go on ahead and look for the most symmetric solution, and simply that of ADS-5. This is Einstein's equations in five dimensions with a cosmological constant. And ADS-5 has a geometry which looks like this right here. It has a throat in the fifth dimension, which is U here. And at U equals 0, it has a boundary. And that boundary has it's basically Minkowski space. That is where we should think of the dual field theory as living. And if this geometry here corresponds to the vacuum, somehow or another deviations in the geometry should correspond to excited states in the quantum field theory. And I'm not going to tell you about how that works for anything but the one-point function for the stress-energy tensor. And the way it works is rather analogous to the image problem in electrodynamics. Okay? In electrodynamics, a problem that we have all solved is that where you take a conductor, you put a charge beneath the conductor, and you're asked to compute what is the electromagnetic field and what is the induced charge density or current density on the conductor. And you did this using the method of images. The same type of thing happens in a ADS-CFT, or just within classical general relativity here. If I imagine putting not an electromagnetic charge, but rather a gravitational charge into the fifth dimension, that gravitational charge will, in fact, induce a stress tensor on the boundary of anti de Sitter space. It's just classical field theory. It doesn't really have anything to do with ADS-CFT itself. Now, if I take this electromagnetic charge here and I wiggle it back and forth, that'll produce electromagnetic radiation, which will in turn produce currents on your conductor. If I move around my mass, I can produce gravitational radiation, and that gravitational radiation will induce currents on the boundary. It'll produce something that looks like radiation in your image stress tensor, in your holographic image stress tensor, if you will. This is all classical field theory here. ADS-CFT comes in terms of the interpretation. ADS-CFT tells you to interpret this right here as the expectation value of an operator in some quantum state. And so that's all that you really need to know from the ADS-CFT side to really understand the rest of my talk. So at the end of the day, I want to study something that behaves as a fluid. I want to study a quantum field theory state which is well described by a density matrix. And so the first question we should ask is, what should the geometry corresponding to a liquid look like? And one simple way you can address this is to first ask, well, what is the geometry corresponding to a static liquid look like? A static liquid has a stress tensor, which is just diagonal, has an energy density and pressures, which are all related to the energy density by an equation of state. And you can kind of solve Einstein's equations in reverse, where you solve Einstein's equations subject to the boundary condition that the image stress is given by this right here. And it's a relatively simple exercise to do. And what you find out is that you get the ADS-Schwarzschild geometry here. This warp factor F vanishes at U equals UH. You have a horizon at UH. So you find that the geometry, which is dual to a liquid, is in fact a black hole geometry. And again, this makes sense insofar that you're trying to describe a quantum state that has entropy. It's described by a density matrix that has some entropy. So there should be some entropy in the gravitational theory. And within this context, it shows up as a black hole. Now, this was for a static fluid. You can now ask what happens if you have a dynamic fluid.
So before you get on, so is there any freedom in specifying the aggression state?
No, it's a conformal theory. What I'm talking about right now is all for conformal theories. So with that said now, you can imagine you have some fluid which is moving. You can zoom in on a cell of fluid. And if hydrodynamics is applicable, by assumption, you can take the size of that cell to be sufficiently small so that in the local fluid rest frame of that cell, the stress tensor is just the same as it is up here. And you can solve Einstein's equations now by adding the fifth dimension in this tube right here. And, of course, you find that the local geometry is just simply that of this right here. And you can glue together a bunch of tubes. And what you find is that the geometry, which is dual to a liquid, is simply that of a black brain, a black hole, rather, whose horizon is sloshing around, mimicking the dynamics of the fluid in the quantum theory. So the message from this is, at the end of the day, is if I want to study a process which ends up having a fluid at late times, I want to study a process where a black hole is created in a five dimensions. Is everybody with me?
So, question that Eric asked, when you say it's a conformal fluid, conformal fluid theory, so does that fix the equation of a state that we don't know what the equation
Well, a conformal field theory has a stress tensor which is traceless.
Okay.
And so.
So that p is vector.
Epsilon. So minus epsilon plus 3p is 0. And that fixes
so that's
your...
generally true. It doesn't depend on that Kennedy coupling.
Nope. And you can also see that it happens from Einstein's equations, too. If you solve Einstein's equations perturbatively near the boundary in a power series expansion in terms of the radial coordinate, you find that the image stress tensor has to be traceless to be consistent with Einstein's equation. Okay?
Just in old classical GR,
I don't know if it's totally unrelated, but I can tell you that this right here is something that you can prove. It's simply just a matter of fact that Einstein's equations in five dimensions with this cosmological constant has the Navier-Stokes equation built into it. You don't have to believe ADS-CFT to get to that conclusion. You just have to believe that Einstein's equations.
I guess it is an important. It's Einstein's equation in the negative and curved space.
Okay. So with all that said, let me describe the most ambitious process that we can study here, which will create a black hole. At the end of the day, we want to study a collision. So perhaps you could have guessed it, the most ambitious thing that we could do is study a collision in five dimensions, a classical collision. And so here's kind of an awkward-looking space-time diagram here. Time runs this way, three-dimensional space that we live in runs this way, and the radial direction is this way right here. And so I think the most ambitious thing you could do is study the collision of two-point particles in anti de Sitter space. They fly at each other, moving at the speed of light. They crash into each other, presumably produce a black hole, which expands and falls into the fifth dimension. Above each point particle, there'll be a holographic image, which is some localized energy density. It'll smash into each other. Once the black hole is formed, you'll have something which starts to behave as a quark gluon plasma on the boundary. Once the black hole relaxes to equilibrium, the quark gluon plasma here will be described by hydrodynamics. So this is a hard problem. You have to do numerical relativity in five dimensions. I'm going to describe to you later on, at the end of the talk, a simplified version of this. But for the time being, let me tell you about the journey to get to the simplified version. So ultimately, I want to study the relaxation of a far-from-equilibrium state. One way of treating the state is to collide things. But there are many other ways you can do it. And I'm going to describe what I think is probably the simplest way within ADS-CFT. So let me start off with a quantum field theory description. You can imagine starting off in some simple state, say the vacuum, and you can turn on some time-dependent fields coupled to operators of interest. So if you imagine the simplest case of, say, a harmonic oscillator, you can start off in the distant past in the N region where the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is 0. You can turn on some sort of external force F for some short period of time and study how the system behaves in the out region, where the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is non-zero. So you can do that for a harmonic oscillator. You can do it for a quantum field theory, which is just a collection of harmonic oscillators. You can start off in the in region where the expectation value of the stress is non-zero. You can turn on some sort of external agent, and you can study the stress tensor in the out region. So in terms of a cartoon here, I have vacuum. I turn on F, which creates pairs of particles. If I tune the polarization of F just right, I can make these particles all have momentum, which lie predominantly in one particular plane. And then after F turns off, I can watch how these things scatter off each other and watch how the system relaxes to equilibrium. So within ADS-CFT, as you'll understand on the next slide, the simplest thing that you can do is take this external force to be an external gravitational field in the 3+1 dimensional world that we live in. So in other words, I'm going to play God with the geometry of space-time. I'm going to warp the geometry of space-time how I please. without caring about the particular equations of motion that this external gravitational field satisfies. So within ADS-C of T, playing with the boundary geometry, I'm sorry, playing with the geometry that we live in corresponds to playing with the boundary geometry of anti de Sitter space. So if I turn on some sort of deformation in the boundary geometry, that's going to create gravitational radiation. This deformation will, in some sense, act like an antenna for gravitational radiation. And that gravitational radiation can fall into the fifth dimension, and it can itself produce a black hole. Okay? And then so you study the relaxation of this black hole. You study the relaxation of the dual quark-gluon plasma. So the utility of doing this is that the deformation can have any desired space-time symmetries that you want. Okay? And so the example I'm going to tell you about is that where the deformation is boost invariant. So if this is my boundary geometry here, I deform it only along this hyperbola here, where I've defined proper time to be v here to be square, t squared minus x squared here.
Sometimes shockwave?
Yeah. In some sense, it's some kind of shockwave that I'm putting in by hand. Okay?
That's a superluminal shockwave.
No, it moves at the speed of light.
Well, it starts at some point, right? Asymptotically moves at the speed of light.
Well, it moves at the speed of light or less than the speed of light. It's only a function of proper time, so it's not moving superluminally.
It's within the cone.
It's within the light cone. Right?
Yeah, see, here's the light cone is the dashed line here. It's not superluminal.
Well, but at that point, the tip of this thing is moving faster than the speed of light because it moves with infinite speed, right?
I mean, near the base of it, you think it's going out that way. I see what you're saying.
I get to play God, so I can do whatever
I
want. Okay, and so the utility of this is, again, because I've chosen the problem to have particular symmetries, the resulting relativity problem only depends upon V and the radial direction. It's so simple that computationally you could solve it on your iPhone. Okay, it really doesn't demand a lot of computing power.
Blackberry.
Oh, you're black. Excuse me. It takes a couple seconds to solve on your laptop computer. It's really not terribly demanding. And it teaches you some lessons which are valuable for the collisions, which I'm going to tell you about.
So the metric is flat everywhere except at that juncture.
Yeah, there's some place with compact support where the metric is not flat. Okay? This is the simplest setting that I can do where the plasma that's produced is not translationally invariant. So one thing that you could have done in the first paper that we wrote on this subject, we chose the deformation to be translationally invariant. But in that situation, there is no hydrodynamic flow. So it's a little bit less interesting, I think. And I've chosen not to tell you about it for that reason. So choosing a coordinate system. You're always free to choose whatever coordinate system you want and make your life good or make your life painful. Anti de Sitter space has the property that if you send a light signal up to the boundary, it'll reach the boundary in a finite amount of time and it will reflect off the boundary. So you have to impose boundary conditions at the boundary because of this. In Minkowski space, a signal takes forever to get to infinity. It just doesn't happen here. So you have to impose boundary conditions there. So you want to choose coordinates which have which implement the boundary conditions in some sort of natural fashion. Another property is that because the boundary behaves as a reflector, all radiation will eventually fall into the fifth dimension. It's natural to choose coordinates which are idealized for falling motion into the fifth dimension. It's also nice to choose coordinates such that the metric is regular if you have a horizon form. And a coordinate system which satisfies all of these properties is that where the metric takes this form right here. V here is my time coordinate. R is the radial coordinate in terms of the one that I called u earlier. R is just 1 over u. The boundary is located not at r equals 0, but r equals infinity here. And v here is a null time coordinate. In particular, lines of constant v represent infalling radial geodesics here. Okay? Now, in this simple problem, which is effectively just 1 plus 1 dimensional, you can actually write down Einstein's equations terms of their various components relatively easily. One thing that you can see right away is that time derivatives always appear in this particular combination right here. This is the directional derivative along outgoing null geodesics, outgoing radial null geodesics. And so here are Einstein's equations. There are five equations. There are three unknowns. And as it turns out, as it always turns out, some of these equations are redundant. This equation right here, which contains second order time derivatives, is a boundary constraint. If it's satisfied at one value of r, the other equations imply that it's satisfied at all values of r. This equation right here is an initial value constraint. If it's satisfied at one value of v, the other equations imply that it's satisfied at all values of v. So the algorithm for solving Einstein's equations here is pretty straightforward. What you do, suppose at some time you're given the function b as initial data. Okay? You solve this equation right here for sigma. You then take the solution there, and you solve this equation for sigma dot. You then solve this equation for b, and this equation for a. And at the end of the day, then you can just compute the field velocities given that the dotted quantities are given by this expression right here. Now, you'll note that nowhere here did I use this equation at all. And there's a subtlety that I'm leaving out here, and that is that equation is implemented as a boundary condition for the other equations at the ADS boundary at r equals infinity. When you work through the details, and this is something I'm not going to provide you with during this talk, when you step forward in time and neglect this equation, you also have to evolve the boundary stress tensor according to the energy momentum conservation equation. Effectively, what you're doing is you're trading this equation right here for a boundary condition at the boundary. And that boundary condition is simply that the boundary stress tensor is conserved. The two statements are equivalent. So at the end of the day, you end up evolving this function b as well as the boundary stress tensor. Okay? Any questions? There are a lot of details that I left out there. Yeah. Okay, so let me just show you the pictures here.
You're right. So if we are solving an ADS, so there is the Einstein equation automatically imply conservation of the stress energy and stresslessness.
Yep.
So you're saying that now, because I'm returning the non-normalizable component, I'm introducing a source for the TMU. So the conservation of the stress energy tensor has a right-hand side. And that's
it's just covariantly conserved. It's just you turn the partial derivative into a covariant derivative.
Well, it's not zero anymore.
It's still zero. You know, before,
but now
in flat space it was this. In curved space, it's this.
Sure, but now you have a source for now
you're adding, of course, you're adding energy to the system, but it all follows just from this equation right here.
Okay, and what about the tracelessness condition? Now the theory.
I don't remember, but it doesn't have to be traceless. There can be curvature terms, I believe. Yeah, but that's all. It's buried in the details, but I assure you it works out.
Yeah, sure.
But of course, for the problem I'm going to tell you about later on, the conservation equation is just this, and you still have to evolve the boundary stress tensor.
So there's a cosmological constant in here, right? Is that where the 4 is?
Yeah, I chose units where that's 1. I'm sorry, where the ADS curvature radius is 1. So, you know, the units don't work out.
So 4 is what knows about that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think it's probably sprinkled throughout in other terms, too. I don't remember off the top of my head.
But you just said that TMU is not traceless, though, right?
When I turn on the boundary deformation, I don't think it has to be, if I remember correctly.
You're right. But the question is it just a conformal anomaly?
It's just the conformal anomy, yeah.
Okay.
I
was asking whether there is something extra.
No. It's just something proportional to curvature to some power of your space.
It's still the Einstein.
It doesn't produce any technical difficulty. Mm-hmm. So, okay, you know, when a black hole forms, you have singularities. Fortunately, the numerical relativists have taught us how to deal with that. Please allow me just to skip over this slide in the interest of time and just simply say that to deal with excision, you have to find an apparent horizon, which always exists inside the black hole. And if you work out the equation that the apparent horizon satisfies, it turns out to be very simple. It's just that sigma dot evaluated at the apparent horizon position is zero. So at the end of the day, we're going to look for this right here in our solution, and we're going to cut off the numerical integration slightly beyond that. So here are the pictures here. This right here is a space-time diagram turned on its side here. So time runs from left to right. This is the radial direction u, so u equals 0 is the boundary. U going this way is deep in the bulk here. The coloring here is g00, or rather minus g00, divided by r squared. And the flow lines superimposed on this plot are the trajectories of light rays. So if you imagine dangling a string of light bulbs into the fifth dimension and turning them on for a moment and turning them off and following their trajectories, that's what these flow lines here represent. So what you see is that at this time right here, this perturbation is not turned on. All of these light rays are just straight lines. As the boundary geometry perturbation is turned on, this congruence of geodesics radically changes. In particular, you see the development of a bifurcation in the congruence. Some geodesics escape up to the boundary. Some fall deep into the bulk. There's precisely one that does neither. That is the blue curve there. And that is the location of the true event horizon of the system. So this is kind of the textbook image of black hole formation here. Okay. So that was the gravitational physics. Once you have the gravitational picture, you can go on ahead and extract the image stress tensor. And that's what I've shown you right here. Energy density, transverse pressure, longitudinal pressure, where transverse means perpendicular to the direction that these shocks are expanding in. And so what you see is that the energy density generally increases. The pressures oscillate as you're doing work on the system. I should say that during this stage of the evolution, most of the amplitude of the oscillations here is just coming from contributions that are purely geometric in nature. They only depend upon the fact that I'm wiggling the boundary geometry. They don't depend upon anything that's happening in the bulk. And after this perturbation turns off, you see that the system relaxes to something which is rather smooth. And here I've zoomed in on that relaxation right here. And long ago, the hydrodynamic expansion within boost invariant flow was explored within ADS-CFT, and you can go ahead and calculate what the stress tensor is perturbatively in powers of proper time. And to second order, what you get is something which is down here. This constant C1 is related to the viscosity, and this constant C2 is related to second order relaxation times. There's only one unknown parameter here, and that is simply the scale lambda. And so you can go ahead and take these curves and fit to one parameter lambda. And you see that you end up getting remarkable agreement at late times. So, you know, here, after this perturbation has turned off, space is flat. The system's very far from equilibrium. One of the pressures is, in fact, negative. The pressures are basically equal and opposite. So it's very far from equilibrium. I'll put units on this on the next slide, but let me just say that it relaxes remarkably quickly. So here is the relaxation time measured in units of the local temperature. The temperature only varies with time, like time to the 1/3 power, so the temperature is roughly constant. So this is a meaningful thing to plot here. This is plotted versus the amplitude of the deformation. And so you see that as the amplitude of the deformation becomes larger and larger, so does the relaxation time measured in units of temperature. Or, I'm sorry, the relaxation time measured in units of temperature becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. The system relaxes faster and faster and faster the harder I kick it. The explanation for that's rather simple. This is a conformal field theory. As I kick the system harder and harder and harder, the temperature becomes larger and larger and larger. The relaxation time is governed by the temperature. So if I have an infinite temperature, I have an arbitrarily short relaxation time. Now, if I go back to this picture right here, if I kick the system so hard that it's in equilibrium at this time right here, I don't really learn anything about the physics of thermalization. I'm starting to get an answer which is sensitive to how I excited the system. So that's not really the interesting regime to study. The more interesting regime is this limit right here, where epsilon goes to zero. And the numerics become a little bit challenging here because you start to develop a large separation of scales. But I don't think it takes much of a leap of faith to say that this asymptote is something of about a half or so. Now, let me just say at this moment that it's kind of cute that if you go ahead and take a temperature relevant from Rick, relevant for heavy ion collisions, you end up getting a relaxation time which is about 0.3 Fermi over C, something which is well within the tolerances to match the experiment. I'll come back to that in a few minutes.
Even though all this form of black hole independent what epsilon
is? As it turns out, the answer is yes. I can elaborate on that more later, but...
arbitrarily small epsilon.
Yes. Even if epsilon is infinitesimal.
Wow.
I got 15 minutes. Let me skip that. And I have much more interesting stuff that I want to tell you in two or three slides. But I can tell you that at the end. So the interesting limit is epsilon goes to zero. And in that limit, you can actually solve Einstein's equations perturbatively in powers of epsilon. And this was actually done in a paper by Sharesman Walla and company for a translationally invariant situation. Now, the surprising result, as I just said, is that even when epsilon goes to zero, you do have a black hole. Okay. And the reason, one reason you can understand this is that when epsilon goes to zero, you've done a very small amount of work on something, and so you have a very small temperature, which will show up on long-distance correlation functions. Okay. In the bulk, if I have a black hole, at the location of the horizon of the black hole, there'll be an order one change in the geometry. Okay? And so what that means is that when I do this sort of expansion right here, if I want to have a well-defined perturbative expansion, I have to do some sort of resummation near the horizon. Okay? And at the end of the day, what you find if you work out the details is that there is, in fact, a black hole at order epsilon to the zero. And so now you can answer this question of why this curve slopes down like this. Why is the relaxation time, why is T hydro times the temperature the smallest when the deformation is the smallest? And the answer is simply that when I turn on this deformation in my boundary geometry, I'm going to produce gravitational radiation. And what can happen is that G1 can scatter off of G0. Okay? And come in there, bounce off the boundary, and then get absorbed by the horizon. So the higher order terms in epsilon only make the system take longer to relax. Okay. So that is the origin of that there.
Sorry. Just for clarification. So before when you were talking in general, you were evolving a vacuum state and you were kicking a vacuum state.
Yes.
Now, are you kicking the vacuum state of n equal 4 as well, or you are kicking a thermal state?
I'm kicking the vacuum state of n equal
still
4.
Still vacuum.
Let me just answer your question in the case of a translationally invariant kick. Okay? First of all, think about quantum field theory. I turn on some field, I add energy to the system, it's done so in a translationally invariant fashion. After I turn off the kick, you're going to be guaranteed that you'll have a stress. And in particular, you're going to be guaranteed that epsilon and p are time independent. Okay? So now go back now to the exercise that I gave you on many slides back, where I said solve Einstein's equations subject to this boundary condition. You're going to be forced to have a black hole. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You can do this for an infinitesimal amplitude. The black hole will have a radius which lies deeper and deeper in the bulk, that will correspond to a temperature in your quantum field theory, which is less and less and less, but you're going to be guaranteed that it happens.
So the limit epsilon zero, it's a zero radius black hole?
It has an infinitesimal temperature. So the temperature, you can just compute what epsilon is from, sorry, let me use a different symbol
here. Infinite, right?
So epsilon, you can actually compute from linear response, and this scales like what I called epsilon squared. And so the temperature scales like the square root of epsilon.
Temperature goes like 1 over the mass. So what do you have, infinite temperature, you said, or zero temperature?
Zero temperature.
That's infinite mass.
So he's talking about a planar black hole.
Yeah.
You're talking about a different kind of black hole.
All right.
Your intuition doesn't apply. I mean, another thing to say is that when he says translationally invariant, what he means is he's dumping an infinite amount of energy into the system.
Right, but over all space.
It draws the reaction.
Thank you. Okay, so this was the warm-up problem. This is what I worked on about a year ago or so, and I've spent almost the last 2 years working on generalizing this to adding just one extra dimension. And you write down Einstein's equations, you look at them, you think I can do this in 6 weeks, and then you find out that it takes you 2 years. So the next interesting problem to study, the one which is much more, well, which I think the experimentalists will take much more seriously than playing God with the geometry of space-time, is the collision of sheets of matter. So I told you earlier in the talk the most ambitious thing is the collision of point particles. You can imagine taking an ensemble of point particles and forming a sheet within the gravitational theory. And in the conformal field theory, that corresponds to just colliding sheets of matter here. And as I told you earlier, it's a conformal field theory. There's no mass, so I get to engineer these sheets to be whatever I want. Now, it turns out that you actually don't even need to have the point particles in the bulk to study this sort of problem. You get exactly the same image stress tensor when you remove the point particles altogether. The cost of that, though, is, well, so first of all, the benefit is that you don't have to solve for the evolution of the point particles. The cost of that is that the shockwave metric, the metric corresponding to each one of these gravitational waves here becomes singular in the infrared. Okay, so this is the problem I'm going to tell you about here in the last 10 minutes. It's a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory problem once you've dimensionally reduced it. It's a 2 plus 1 dimensional numerical relativity problem once you've dimensionally reduced it from 5, because everything's translationally invariant in the transverse direction. So the good coordinates to use for this problem are a very straightforward generalization of the other coordinates that I used. In particular, now I'm going to allow dynamics in the z direction, so I can just add this sort of term right here, where I have one extra function f. Now everything, instead of just depending upon r and v, also depends upon z. And there are a couple issues associated with this, but let me say before I tell you about the issues, that when you write down Einstein's equations, they become horrible and messy, but if you stare at them long enough, you can recognize the same patterns that existed in the 1 plus 1 dimensional formulation. And the exact same algorithm works to solve them. It's at the end of the day, in the 1 plus 1 dimensional formulation, I had to solve first order ordinary differential equations to compute the field velocities. It works out exactly the same way here. Okay? And at the end of the day, I have to evolve the boundary stress tensor simultaneously with some of the Einstein equations. So with this sort of metric right here, there are a couple challenges, though. And the first challenge is that for these gravitational wave solutions that I talked about on the previous slide, we know what they are analytically in a certain coordinate system. And that coordinate system is Fefferman-Gram coordinates. This function phi is one that you're free to choose. Any phi you want gives you an exact solution to Einstein's equations. Again, this is just because you're describing a conformal field theory. You get to engineer the wave packet to be whatever you want. I'll choose it to be a Gaussian. And so you have to do a coordinate transformation that takes you from this metric to this metric. And that coordinate transformation is nasty. You have to do it numerically. And you have to do it not just well, but you have to do it very well. Because there is a singular point at r equals infinity. And your boundary stress tensor is going to be determined by the asymptotics of this metric. So if there's any hope of doing this, you have to do the coordinate transformation very well, and you have to handle the asymptotics at r equals infinity very well, too. The other problem is that there's a 1 over r to the fourth sickness here. As I take r to 0, this term becomes huge. When you do the coordinate transformation, this 1 over r to the fourth sickness translates into rapid variations in the new radial coordinate up here, as well as z here. So, you know, there are probably many ways to deal with these things. I'm just going to tell you about what I did. The first thing is to deal with the boundary asymptotics and the coordinate transformation. I used spectral methods. I treated the radial direction using Chebyshev polynomials and the z direction using a Fourier series. For the second problem, one solution is simply to use a different shock that doesn't have a 1 over r to the fourth behavior deep in the bulk. You can do this by adding a source at the cost of having to solve for the dynamics of the source. My solution was simply to introduce an artificial infrared cutoff in the form of a small background energy density. So instead of studying the collision of two sheets of matter in vacuum, I'm studying the collision of two sheets of matter in a plasma where the temperature of the background plasma is taken sufficiently small and the time evolved is taken sufficiently small so that it doesn't really affect any of the dynamics. It's just a convenient tool to fix this 1 over r to the fourth sickness here. Okay, any questions? So here's the picture that you get. I promise you it looks much nicer on my laptop. The initial state was taken to be two Gaussian wave packets with the energy density per unit transverse area, which is just mu. So everything here is measured in terms of units of mu equals 1. And this is a space-time diagram here with time running like this, space running like this. So if you integrate this Gaussian right here, you get 1. The width was taken to be this, and the background temperature was taken to be this. The background energy density is basically 30 times smaller than that of the shock here, so you really don't even see it. And so what happens is that these things move together at the speed of light. They crash into each other. You can see the energy density dramatically increases. And what you get, what comes out, looks dramatically different than what went in. You see two little lumps here in the energy density. They're expanding almost at the speed of light. And you see some residual energy that's left over at z equals 0. For some reason, I started calling z x parallel here, so sorry. So that right there is the picture of the energy density. This is something that I just got working in the last week or so. So it'll appear in the archive probably next week. So let me do the same thing I did before. Let me compare to hydrodynamics. So, you know, of course, I can compare to hydrodynamics at many different locations. Let me just, for simplicity, do this at x parallel at z equals 0, because by parity, I've chosen a parity symmetric situation here. By parity, the fluid velocity vanishes right here, as does the derivative of the energy density there. And so it's very simple to write down the constituent relations for hydrodynamics. The pressure in the longitudinal direction along the collision axis is just given by this simple expression, where T is the temperature. This term is a viscous correction. And the transverse pressure is given by this, where the temperature is just given by the fourth root of the energy density here. These are the hydrodynamic constituent relations for the nonlinear hydrodynamics. Okay? So the solid curves here are what you get from ADS-CFT. The dashed curves are what you get from hydrodynamics. And you see that they start to agree just very well at about a time of 1 here, maybe 1.5, okay? So here you are for the relaxation time, 3 halves mu to the minus 1/3, or if you measure that again in terms of the local temperature, you get 1 over 2 T. So encouragingly, that's the same result that I got before in the 1 plus 1 dimensional setting. Okay, any questions at this point? I'm almost done.
You're saying these agree, what agree very well with what?
I'm sorry?
You said that the two things agree very well with each other?
Yeah, you have the solid curves are the transverse and longitudinal pressure that you get with the exact calculation. The dash curves are what you get using the hydrodynamic constituent relations. Okay? They're two independent quantities at some level.
Constituent relation,
what I mean is that in the local, so hydrodynamics is an effective theory. And your relevant variables are an energy density and the fluid velocity. Okay? And in the local fluid rest frame, your stress tensor is epsilon. And I have 5 minutes. I got to kiss. So these are the constituent relations for hydrodynamics, and you can continue on to go out to second order, third order, however ambitious you are. Okay.
So they work great for that larger V, and they're just useless for small.
Which makes sense, yeah. Right? You have a system that's very far from equilibrium at early times. At early times, the longitudinal pressure is 5 times greater than the transverse pressure. Hydrodynamics only works when locally the system is isotropic, when there's only one pressure. You'll note furthermore, too, that even when hydrodynamics is working very well, the system is still very anisotropic. And if you go back over here, if I neglect viscosity, the system has to be isotropic. So what you're seeing is a huge contribution from viscosity. It seems peculiar because, you know, each term in your series expansion should be smaller and smaller and smaller. And if the second term is just as large as the first term, you wouldn't expect it to really be a good expansion. But evidently, it's working very well there.
Now, since you have 2 more minutes, you want to waste them. How about also plotting dotted lines? And dotted lines, I mean, we know what the second of the hydro is, right? So did you try to see whether the agreement between the real evolution?
I didn't do it for this problem yet.
Right.
As I said, I just got these results a week ago. The first thing I want to do is just look at other positions in x parallel equals zero. Now, if I go back right here,
yeah.
I did do second order hydro. And when I removed the second term, the agreement was not as good.
So adding the hydro makes the agreement worse?
Makes it better.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, when people do simulations of heavy ion collisions, the second order terms are basically only there to stabilize the code. They don't really have any noticeable effect.
But you do have large gradients, as you're pointing out.
Mm-hmm.
The large, mm-hmm. Because that's the difference between transverse and longitudinal
pressure, right.
Comes because the gradient.
Now, let me make one more comment here, too. And that is at this slide right here. For this slide, for all the times shown and for the given lambda that comes from the fit, these series expansions are converging very well. Each term is about 10 times smaller than the other one for this right here. And yet hydrodynamics is still not working. And that's simply reflecting that the relevant degrees of freedom, well, the relevant measure of the applicability of hydrodynamics is not the convergence of the series, but rather the relaxation times associated with non-hydrodynamic modes. So that.
Why in all your plots I don't see the excitation of quasi normal modes?
You do.
Sort of, you do? You
well.
I have to blow up the plot to see the small.
If I study the translationally invariant case, you see pressures oscillate more clearly. But in the case of boost invariant flow, your quasi normal modes are just different. You don't really see these oscillations directly.
Oh, the quasi normal modes are.
You have your quasi-normal modes. The ones that most people are used to studying are that of on top of a static black hole. This is not a static black hole. If you wait long enough and look at the appropriate time scales, you would. If you wait long enough and look at the appropriate time scales, you would expect to see them.
Quasi-normal modes are the same as an aesthetic one, even though the temperature slightly goes.
If you wait long enough and look at the appropriate time scales, but evidently
you don't have data and you don't.
I've done it for the translationally invariant case, and they agree perfect.
Okay.
They agree perfectly. So that's it. So my summary is simply that very difficult quantum field theory problems are now accessible using holography and numerical relativity. It's not perfect at the moment. There's no known dual to QCD or to any theory of nature, but nevertheless, you know, this is the first time we've really been able to study far from equilibrium dynamics in a quantum field theory. In terms of results, I think that they are encouraging. Relaxation times associated with the conformal field theory are about 0.3 Fermi over C if you take a temperature relevant from Rick. The experiment says that they're less than 1 Fermi over C. Now, let me just say something that I should have said earlier. The experiment only says that it's less. It doesn't say that it is 1 Fermi over C. It could be 100 times smaller. It just says that it's less. Perturbative calculations in QCD are about 3 times larger with order 1 uncertainties. There are a lot of open questions, and I think the big one here is any of this relevant for heavy ion collisions? One thing that you see from this plot back here is that these shocks basically annihilate each other. What you see flying out is something which is smeared out. It doesn't even move at the speed of light. In fact, it moves a little bit less than the speed of light. It's completely different than QCD. In QCD, in a real heavy ion collision, when two nuclei smash into each other, something like 95 or 97% of the energy continues along the forward direction, hardly interacting at all. So this is something that's very different. So, you know, relevance for heavy ion collisions is something that is unanswered. At the moment, I've only addressed thermalization within the context of a one-point function. Just because your one-point function is described by hydrodynamics doesn't mean that your two-point function will be as well at the same time. So I think another interesting thing to study is correlation functions. You know, in thermal equilibrium, retarded and advanced Green's functions are related to time-ordered Green's functions. It would be very nice to compute these quantities and see at what time they start to contain the same information. Another interesting question is simply lower bounds on thermalization times. From what I've done, I haven't found anything that relaxes faster than 1 over 2t. I know that in the paper that Tresman-Walla wrote a few years ago, looking at the same type of problem in 2 plus 1 dimensional theories, he found that the relaxation time can be arbitrarily short. So it would be nice to do some sort of analytic analysis and see if we can the lower bound on the thermalization time.
You mean by the thermalization time is the temperature?
Yes.
And he thinks it can be arbitrarily short.
Arbitrarily short. It can be instantaneous.
In odd dimensions.
In odd dimensions, yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's it. Thanks for your attention.
This business where you put in the pulse and you let it go down, so get a black hole, what happens if you shrink the width but keep the amplitude the same? Same kind of thing?
The numerics become hard. If you shrink the width and you make it a delta function,
yeah. You
actually start to add infinite energy to the system. You're not allowed to make it discontinuous. It's against the rules. You can reason this from linear response, actually. You don't need any ADS-CFT. You can reason that if your external forcing agent is discontinuous, you add infinite energy to the system. So you have an infinite.
So you just can't make sense of it when you have a narrow pulse.
I mean, as long as it has a finite width, it makes sense. But the amount of energy that you're going to add is going to be proportional to 1 over the width to the fourth power.
Okay.
Just on dimensional grounds. Right. So if you make that width 0, you have infinite energy.
Okay.
You can take it to 0, keeping the energy.
Keeping the what?
The energy fixed.
Sure, you could probably do that. You'd have to decrease the amplitude as well. But for fixed amplitude, it becomes a sick problem.
So I'm very naive in this. So what is the value of eta that you use?
The value of eta is predetermined. Every single theory that has a gravitational description has eta over s equals 1 over 4 pi.
Okay, so use that.
So it's already computed.
I'm going to try to do the full problem particles where you can actually put finite energy in the system.
I have no intention of doing it, of doing that anytime soon. Although I suspect and I hope that others do.
So this thermalization time,
So just because your hydro agrees quite well, so that's the thermalization times it enters air is just a second order coefficient, right? That's tau sub phi. Is that correct?
No, this is the relaxation of non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. Doesn't give a damn about the series the hydrodynamic expansion.
No, but how do you, okay, then I completely misunderstood your dashed line. So what is the dashed line?
The dashed line is what you get if you assume hydrodynamics works.
That's what I'm asking. So yeah. And it looks like that it works very nicely with your, you know, with...
Yeah, it agrees.
You know, with your real data. So
at sufficiently late times, it agrees, yes.
I would say that it's not only sufficiently late time, it agrees pretty well everywhere.
This,
I mean,
this is
the shape's a little bit shifted, and it's almost fair to say that the hydro works always for the in a particular problem, you know, qualitative.
This is highly misleading.
Why? Okay.
Because I'm not evolving anything according to the equations of hydrodynamics right now. I'm just testing the constituent relations. If you start off with this as initial data right here, and evolve with hydrodynamics,
okay,
you're not going to end up with the same state.
I see. Okay, so I didn't understand it. So okay. So what does then the dashed line?
The dashed lines are the pressures that you would get if you just assumed the hydrodynamic constituent relations hold. So the pressures that you get from ADS-CFT are given in terms of you know, various parts of the asymptotics of the of the geometry. And the same thing with the energy density and the energy flux.
Right.
So what I'm saying is throw away all the information that you got about the spatial stress from ADS-CFT and just construct what you would get for the spatial stress if you use the energy density and the flux that you got from ADS-CFT. Okay, so I'm saying take the energy density, take the fluid velocity, and then plug them into this formula right here and see how well this formula works. And it works great. You know, alternatively, you could try to evolve hydrodynamics with some initial conditions. It's harder.
Okay, so you're saying that it satisfies constitutive relations with, you know, with the right transport conditions.
Right.
Okay.
You could do better. But like I said, I just did
this
a week
ago. But still, even there, in those relations, there is a relaxation time, right?
There is a second order. There are second order, third order, tenth order transport coefficients.
Okay, so here it's just the first order.
Yep.
First order hydro.
And of course, if you didn't use first order, if you used ideal hydro, this would be terrible. It would be absolutely terrible. You know, the whole reason why there's a difference in the pressure is due to viscosity.
That dotted line, in some sense, is your benchmark, right? That's how you define this relaxation time.
Yeah, right now, yeah.
Zero to the place where. So if you add the second order term, it doesn't change.
I haven't done it.
But your intuition, it's not going to.
Just from what I know about the boost invariant flow,
yeah.
It doesn't change the relaxation time. It just changes the quality of the fit, but it's still very good.
And there is no, you don't see any relation.
What I'm saying is, right now, on the plots that I showed you, these two lines are dead on top of each other. If you don't include the second order term, they're off by a little bit. But for an experimentalist, being off by a few percent is not a big deal. Being off by 20% is a big deal. So it doesn't change the relaxation time in that sense. Does that make sense?
No, I'm sorry. What exactly is your relaxation time? How did you? I thought.
It's,
or you're saying the fit doesn't improve in time? It's just, I mean, infinitesimally, all, you know, there's a small deviation there, it'll get closer.
Right. Well, I'm not defining it crisply here. I'm just saying, look at the plot and see when the two curves agree.
Yeah.
Now, you might say 1. Somebody else might say 1.5. It's not much of a difference. It's not a crisply defined quantity.
But your intuition is if I add second order terms, those dotted lines are going to move around.
They're going to move around, but it's not going to look any different.
But
if you zoom in right, if you zoom in right here, you'll see these two curves are not dead on top of each other.
Yeah.
They'll be closer.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's not going to change things dramatically. You know, if I for this particular plot that I showed you back right here, it doesn't change anything at all. When I reduce the amplitude of my kick down to be something very small is when you can really start to see it. But it's certainly something that you can see and test in America and see that you're really doing a good job. If I go back, I didn't show you this plot. Sorry, I think I have a plot here. You guys have seen all my other talks here. This is a plot of the horizon areas as a function of proper time for the case of boost invariant flow. And you have an apparent horizon, which is the pink curve, and that area grows causally. And then you have the blue curve, which is the true horizon, whose area is increasing in the distant past before you've even done anything. And you can see when I zoom in here that the perturbative expansions that were computed a long time ago agree just perfectly to a fraction of a percent level here. Now, when you start to throw away these second-order terms here, you know, well, first of all, you throw away these two terms right here, and your first-order terms are identical, and you start to just get one curve instead of two. Okay? Does that make sense? So at this level right here, you can really see the second-order coefficient, the importance of it. And, okay, so you have 18 and maybe 0.2 difference here. So you have 0.2 divided by 18. That's pretty small.
What is the effect of adding a chemical potential?
It doesn't change anything, I think. Simply because the coupling of the electromagnetic field is going to be 1 over n suppressed.
Any other questions? So Paul will be around for maybe an hour or two more before he begins to drive back to Boston. And because you said iPhone, you're not going to get a reimbursement. Thank you.